Before Christmas, we had reached a point in our series in the Gospel of Matthew that brought us up to chapter 18. And so it's been a few weeks, and I just want to remind you of a few things. Remember that Matthew is the most Jewish of all the Gospels. And Matthew's focus is, again, on the kingdom of God, focusing on the kingdom that is to come. I also want to remind you how that Jesus, during this time, during his earthly ministry, Matthew focuses on not just the kingdom, but his presentation. Up until chapter 13, Jesus began to speak openly and teach openly. There were really no questions about what he was saying. But after 13, because of the rejection of the kingdom from the Jewish people, he began to teach in parables, you might remember. And part of the reason was to hide truth from those who were blind and to reveal truth to those who believed. And so it was also to promote his ministry to accomplish what needed to be done. And remember, it was also during that time that he was performing many miracles. And those miracles, again, were to authenticate the message that he brought from God. And that was one of the requirements that the Jewish people sought after. They sought after signs to authenticate the message and the messenger. Now that kind of brings us to our title today, and we're in Matthew chapter 19. So if you want to turn to Matthew 19, here's our title: Three Practices of God Honoring Marriages. We're also going to spend some time in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Three principles or three practices of God honoring marriage. And you might think this title a little strange, or the subject a little strange, as we end 2012 focusing or looking towards 2013 with the new theme of Dare to Share. But I hope that by the time we're done today that you'll see that there is a major connection to missions. And here's just a side note, too, just a couple of things. I'm not going to speak today on the movement afoot in our country with homosexual marriage, but I will say a couple of things. One, that I believe within the next 10 years, the Supreme Court will rule on this and it will be legal in our country. I don't think there's any way around it. I'm not being negative, I'm just being realistic. And I hope that our young people, and many aren't here today, but I hope that they'll rise up and they'll continue to maintain biblical principles that they've been taught here and other places. The second thing is this. I heard a writer, or I read a writer, or heard someone once say that you can make it legal, but you can never make it right. And that's the truth. You can make it legal, but you can never make it right, because you cannot legitimize something that God condemns, that God says is sin. And so, now that I've said that, my little side note, let's come back to Matthew 19 for just a moment. Outside of preaching and teaching, the majority of my time is spent in three areas: study, prayer, and pastoral counseling. And it's in that third area that probably the most difficult part of my ministry lies, because there are so many issues. Numerous hours are spent each month dealing with individuals and couples, primarily around marital issues, relationship issues. And I'll be quite frank with you, it is one of the most difficult areas I deal with, but it's also one of the most rewarding. When I watch couples begin to grow, where they grow in their relationship with Christ and they grow in their relationship with others and each other, it really is quite rewarding. But then it can also be the most frustrating thing that I ever do. It makes me want to pull my hair out some days. Actually, it makes me want to shout, not out of happiness, but it makes me want to shout and strangle some folks. And the reason being is that everyone comes in to these situations with their own biases. were their own ideas of what marriage is, and it's based primarily on what they have been taught, what they have seen modeled for them. And so, put the scriptures aside, people come in to relationships oftentimes thinking that they know what the relationship should look like, feel like, and be like based upon their past experiences and based upon what they've learned from their own parents and their own families. But to be quite frank with you, most people today have no idea what a healthy relationship or a healthy marriage is to look like, be like, or feel like, much less how it's to function from a scriptural standpoint. Many of us, many Christians, come into the congregation, they come into the church building, and they clean up nice, and they dress up nice, and they put on a nice face, but at home, sometimes it seems like everything is falling apart. We want, or we project, certain ideas and things that we want people to believe, and they're not always that way. Again, we need to realize that for most of us, we're simply passing on things that we've learned, destructive tendencies that have been demonstrated for us with our own parents or grandparents or other relationships. So we shouldn't really be surprised at the enormous amount of dysfunction within our country today, because marriage and family is one of the basic foundations of our society. Matter of fact, it's the basic foundation for any society and people. Here's the process that are steps that most follow today. A young man or a young woman finds someone physically attractive. And so they begin to think, wow, let's carry that to the next step. The next step is no longer, let me tell that person I love them and propose to them. The next step is, let's have a physical relationship. And then they'll go beyond that and they'll say, well, I like you well enough and I enjoy our time together and what we do together. Let's move in together. And so they move in together, and then after a significant amount of time, they may consider, I might want to marry this person. That's the process that we see in our country today, even in our churches. They entertain the idea of marriage. It's kind of like this. If you or I were to go to a car dealership, and we're looking for a new car, now's the time to buy. If you're going to buy a new car, the end of December is a great time to buy because they want to move those cars off the lot. But you go to the dealership and you talk to the owner and you kind of want to buy a new car, but you're not really ready to commit. And you say to the owner, let's have this agreement. You let me drive this car for the next year or so, and I might buy it. It's kind of like that old saying, how's it go? Why buy the milk when you get the cow for free? We might change around a little bit and say, why buy the car when you can drive for free, right? And so that's the idea. No one in their right mind is going to make that kind of deal, are they? I don't know of any car dealership that will let you test drive a car for a year or two. But normally what happens after a year or two, that car gets a few dings and it gets a little older. The paint begins to fade and there's crumbs between the seats and in the floorboard. Because some of you are nasty in your cars, right? And you begin to think, you know, those 2014s are coming out. They look pretty good. And so the idea is, if I like her, I'll keep her, but if I don't, I'll just get a new one. And ladies, especially young ladies, those who are listening and may listen to this message later on, let me tell you something. If that's the way a young man looks at you and that's the way he feels about you, he's not worthy of your time. You need to kick him down the road. And you need to find someone that's going to appreciate you for who God made you to be. And so now, in order to establish healthy relationships and healthy marriages, God has given us numerous principles throughout His Word. And I just want to show you three today. But He's given us these principles and teachings that protect families, that protect individuals. And in the long run, it honors Him. It protects society. It protects the culture and sanctity of marriage. It holds everything together. Here's our first point this morning. The first step of a God-honoring marriage is based upon a choice to leave, cleave, and be united as one. To leave, cleave, and be. Let me give you a little history before I give you this passage. Jesus is leaving Capernaum for the last time. He's making His way down to Jerusalem because He has a date with destiny. He has a date with the cross. And as He's working His way down, He goes behind Samaria. He goes into a new area where He hasn't been before in His ministry. And He's continuing His teaching and healing. And of course, there are those Pharisees and others who are coming and bringing Him these questions, trying to trip Him up. And so as He's working His way down, He's still ministering to these people. And these Pharisees and others who are trying to trip Him up, remember the Sermon on the Mount. And the Sermon on the Mount, you might remember, is chapters 5, 6, and 7 of the Gospel of Matthew. And in that, He talks about divorce. He makes a statement about divorce, which is so much, we might say, a little stricter in its interpretation than what the people had been taught of His day. The rabbis and others, His other contemporaries, tended to be a little more liberal in their interpretation of certain passages. And there were two schools of thought. The one school, Shammai, was very strict concerning the reasons for divorce, that it only be for certain reasons. And then there was the school of Hillel. And Hillel was a great teacher, and he took a little more lenient view, and that's where most of the people went, particularly the men, because they really liked the teaching that said you could divorce your wife for any reason. It's based upon Deuteronomy 24:1, and we'll look at that in just a moment. But look at our first passage here. In Matthew 19, verses 3 through 6, "And the Pharisees came up to Him and tested Him by asking," or tempting Him, "is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" Because He had already dealt with this early on in His ministry. He answered, "Have you not read that He who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife," or cleave to his wife, "and the two shall become," or be, "one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." I love what Jesus does. He takes them back to the beginning. He takes them back to the Word of God, to the time of creation when God begins to reveal and establish His plan. Now, notice this three-step process that's based upon a choice. The first thing He says is to leave. The word leave means to forsake, abandon, relinquish. It literally means to move to a new location, to move out. Don't think, if you haven't been married yet, for some of our younger ones, that you're going to get married and live at home. That's what He's saying. If you're big enough to get married, get your tail out. You need to separate yourself from mommy and daddy. Because if you're big enough to be married, then you're big enough to be on your own and take care of your own needs. You don't need in-laws
nosing in where they don't belong. And if you live in their house, guess what? They're going to butt in. You can't have the marriage that God intends for you to have. Here's the second thing, the word cleave. Or here it says hold fast to, which is the correct interpretation. Hold fast to means to stick together like glue. Stick together like glue. Years ago when I was going back to school, I was doing some subcontracting work. And so that was the only thing that really I could do and go to school and do all the other things that need to be done. And there was this adhesive that we would use sometimes to put wood together. We would put it down on floor joists to put the plywood down. And if you've ever tried to pull that stuff up, the wood around it will break before the glue does. Jesus is the glue. That you stick together like glue. And that's one of the things that we'll come back to in a moment, but that's the teaching here, that everything else may break and fall apart, but that bond that you have with another, if it's in Christ, shouldn't break. The third thing he says to become one, to be one flesh. It's speaking of intimacy, not just physical intimacy. It's speaking of spiritually intimate with one another, emotionally intimate with one another, that you open yourselves up, that you become vulnerable to each other. And so that's the idea of what a marriage should look like. Just these three little things, these three little principles. You leave, you cleave, and you be. You be one. You become one. Now, let's talk about cleaving again. Let's go back to that. Because cleaving is associated with love. And many have the idea today. I love it when young couples come in and they're doing premarital counseling with me. And I'll ask the question, well, how do you know you love her? I always start with the male because if the female goes first, he'll go something like ditto. That's the way I feel, right? And so you always start with the male. How do you know you love her? Oh, man. I can't stand to be apart from her. It's almost like she makes my stomach jump. My heart goes pitter-patter and all kinds of stuff. And I'll go, oh, that's really nice. That's so sweet. And she's looking at him and she's smiling and cocking her head. And then I'll ask her and she's got this answer that's a mile long, right? It's the same kind of stuff. It's a little sappy. And they're looking at each other and they're going, ooh and ah. And I'm going, that's not love, that's lust, right? That's not love. That's not love at all. That's some internal feeling that you have because something is welling up in you and you're being human. But that's not what the scriptures tell us love is. At this time of year, people begin to develop new resolutions and things that they're going to do, and they begin to prioritize things. And I'll ask folks, well, what are your priorities? Well, God's first. They always have this list. God's first, then my spouse. And the way they believe it should go is God first, spouse, children or family, church, job. And that's good. But it's so wrong. You shouldn't have a list like that. Actually, it should look like a target. And Christ should be right in the center. And everything else radiates out from it. What's next to your relationship with Christ is your relationship with your spouse. And if Christ is the center of your life, then everything else begins to fall in place. Forget the list. Look at it as a target. And then begin to really focus in on what it means to love. Because God tells us what love is. Greatest verse in the entire Bible, what is it? John what? John 3:16. For God so what? Loved. For God so loved the world that he did what? He had this feeling inside? No. For God so loved the world that he gave. He acted upon a choice. For God so agapao the world, it's a verb. For God so loved the world that he gave the most precious thing that he had, he gave his son. And who did he give it for? You. He gave it to the world that whosoever might believe, what? That they not be lost, that they be saved, right? That they come into a relationship with him. For God so loved the world. God made a choice in eternity past to commit himself to you, not based upon some feeling, but based upon his sovereign will. God chose to enter into a relationship with you if you will only accept. And that's what we need to understand about marriage. And the biblical principles that surround marriage begins with a choice, not a feeling. You can be attracted to someone, but that's not a good reason to be married. Because guess what? We all get a little older. We all get a little heavier. We all get a little slower. We all need a little help sometimes. It's just part of life. And that's what he's telling us here. Let me throw something else out to you, because it's a good point to relay this to you. That Christians should only date Christians. Therefore, Christians should only marry Christians. When you look for a spouse, if you're a Christian today, when you look for a spouse, you should look for someone that has similar beliefs and values as you. And hopefully they're founded in the Word of God. Let me show you this. Two statements from the Apostle Paul. Here's the first. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 39. Paul is dealing, chapter 7 is an interesting chapter because Paul gives us God's opinion. He also shares his opinion. He also tells us some things about the marriage relationship. And we have to keep in mind that these people that he's writing to and talking to were at one time pagans who have now become Christians. And some of them are still married to pagans. But notice what he says. A wife is bound to her husband, and we could say a husband is bound to his wife, as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes. But here's the kicker. What does he say? Only in the Lord. Now, some want to argue that and say, that's not what he's saying. He's not saying only to Christians, but I don't know. How else can you interpret that? Because if you keep the context of chapter 7, what you come to is this conclusion. That you are released from your marriage when the other dies, and you can marry again if you so choose, but you should only marry a Christian. Remember, these were once pagans who are now Christians. And that's an important point to keep in mind as we continue. Here's 2 Corinthians 6, 14 and 15. He says, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness? These are rhetorical questions. Or what fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial or Satan? Or what portion does a believer share with an unbeliever? And some would say, well, this passage doesn't argue or speak directly about marriage. And I would say to that person, you would be correct. It doesn't specifically address marriage, but it certainly lends itself to marriage and, in a general sense, to Christian relationships with other people. Notice again, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. There's an Old Testament picture here, illustration. And there was a law that said that you should not put two different kinds of beast of burdens together. The idea was that you don't want to put a yoke on an ox and a donkey. Because if you do, your rows won't be straight. You'll have one that's really trying to work hard and the other is pulling him along and you kind of mess up. And so here's the picture. That you're not to be unequally yoked. You shouldn't put yourself under the burden of entering into a relationship with another person that's not Christian. Again, be unequally yoked with unbelievers. He's not talking about all relationships because we still have to live in this world. But he's talking about where we surrender ourselves in general to others in certain situations. Generally speaking, that applies to marriage also. Here's our second point. I know the first point in introduction was really long, but bear with me. Number two. If you want to honor God in your marriage, then your mindset should be that divorce is never an option. Never an option. And some of you might say, well, it's too late for me. And I'm sorry to hear that. And maybe it wasn't your choice. God still loves you. Don't think that just because God hates divorce that he somehow hates you, because he doesn't. But here's what we need to understand. One of the toughest things I deal with in ministry, again, comes back to that pastoral care counseling. Because oftentimes couples, normally one person in a couple will come in and they've already made up their mind that they're getting a divorce. And the only reason they come to see me or another counselor or another pastor is because they somehow want to justify their actions, their behaviors. They want me to release them and say, it's okay. It's over with. It's okay. Well, let me tell you something. I don't believe that's true. Here's what I believe, and here's what I've seen, and here's what the Bible teaches, I believe, is that God, when he enters in, he can fix anything. He can fix broken hearts. He can fix broken relationships. He's in the business of fixing broken things. That's just the bottom line. If both individuals are willing to submit themselves to the will of God, nothing is impossible in a relationship. Notice this passage. Go back to Matthew 19. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Now, this is the King James, New King James, and that last little statement you don't always find in newer translations because it's based upon other interpretive text. But here's what he's telling us. I don't have time to go into all of it, but I want to bring out just a couple of points to you. First of all, this writing or certificate of divorce is a legal document. And remember me telling you about the school of Hillel? Well, they're basing it on Deuteronomy 24:1, which says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs. And there's more to it, but basically, any indecency could mean in that day anything from sexual immorality to burning the dinner. Many of the men would use it to say that she's no longer attractive and so I'm going to put her to the side. That's just one, cruel, and two, it is so sinful. Because what it reveals is a sense of selfishness on the heart of man. when Christ says, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, the hardness of your heart based on something else Jesus said in Mark 16 means unbelief. Because of your unbelief, God permitted it. It was His permissive will, but just because it was God's permissive will was not meaning that He condoned it. The key is in verse 8. But from the beginning it was not so. That even with adultery, and let me share this with you. Adultery is first and foremost not a physical act, but a spiritual act. I would encourage you, challenge you, to go back and read Hosea chapters 1 through 3. It is a spiritual act that takes place in the heart of man. Even Christ tells us that adultery takes place where? If you look upon a woman and lust after her, then you have committed what? Adultery already. You can kill people in your mind. You've committed an act of murder. And so it takes place here before it ever takes place physically. But even Jesus is saying that God says from the beginning, from creation, it was not to be. Because when we study the scriptures, we find that God continuously forgives even when His people mess up. As Christians today, when you and I sin, we commit an act of adultery against Christ. And that's the bottom line. Does that mean Christ is going to divorce us? That somehow we're going to lose our salvation? Absolutely not. Because He loves us. He loves us. He loves us unconditionally. It doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt Him. It does. And it hurts our witness. Here's the third and last point. In order to have a God-honoring marriage, you must put self aside and be willing to put the needs of your spouse ahead of your own. Those who have been with me long enough have heard me say this before, but social scientists tell us that there are several areas that cause issues in marriage relationships or in our relationships. It deals with money, children, sex, and in-laws. But based upon the scriptures, this is what I say. Those are only symptomatic of what the real problem is. The real problem isn't money, sex, in-laws, or children. The real problem is based in self. That we are sometimes narcissistic, egotistical, selfish human beings. That is our nature. Case in point. Some of you remember who Joe Theismann is, right? He's actually doing some commercials now. He was a quarterback for the Washington Redskins. And after his playing days, he made this statement. After he divorced his wife, he became a real jerk. And he spoke in the third person and he said, Joe Theismann deserves to be happy. That's why I divorced her. Anybody that speaks about themselves in the third person, they've got an issue, first of all. And second of all, Joe Theismann deserved to be happy simply reveals his attitude of selfishness. That he was no longer willing to be committed to the woman that he had made promises to. Notice this. Matthew 19, 10 through 12, primarily verse 10. The disciple said to him, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry. Now what Mark tells us, the parallel passage, is that they go into this house and the disciples are still questioning Christ. And what they're saying is, what they're revealing is that they have been influenced by their own wicked generation, their own wicked culture. Because what the disciples are saying is, I don't know if I really like this teaching or not. It's better for me not to be married. It's better for me to be able to play the field than to marry this woman and not to divorce her at all. Not have that ability to. That's what they're saying. These are his own disciples. And I can just imagine they're just kind of speaking out loud, right? But isn't that the world we live in today? Don't we live in a no-fault divorce state? Isn't that what our country has gone to? We've made getting married harder than it is to get divorced. If you go into... Could you go tell them to be quiet for a minute, please? Because this is, to me, this is a serious thing. The whole idea that you can walk out on a spouse and children and not think anything about it, you should have your butt kicked. God says it's serious. And we should take it serious, particularly as Christians. It reveals an attitude of selfishness and narcissism that rivals anything else, any other sin in this world. I close with this passage, and I'll try to be quick. 1 Corinthians 7, 12 through 16. To the rest I say, notice Paul says, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever, and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. But as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved, is not bound. God has called you to peace, eirene. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband, or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Remember, these were once pagans. Some are now Christians married to pagans. They haven't converted yet. And what Paul is saying is, marriage is an honorable thing whether you're a Christian or not, because it is foundational to our society and culture. We find it in all society and people groups throughout history. That's what holds everything together. And now in our own country, when we belittle marriage and we say it's no longer between a man and a woman, that anybody can be married, it's a slap in the face to God. But notice again what he says, that if they choose to remain with you, then do so. Because remember I said, our point or our theme for this new year is Dare to Share. It's mission-oriented. And I hoped that by the end it would make sense how it all comes together. The bottom line is this, your first mission begins at home. As a Christian, your first mission is to your spouse and to your children. And if you're saved and they're not, notice what he says in verse 16. For how do you know, wife, how do you know, husband, whether you will save or lead your spouse to Christ, your children to Christ? Missions begins at home. As we close today, two things I want to remind you. That there's an adult Sunday school class that follows this service. And every week I try to go over and answer questions concerning the message. Oftentimes Kenny has a lesson that coincides with the message. And so if you have questions and you want to talk more about this, I'll be in that first Sunday school room. And I hope that you'll come. The second thing is this, that I believe that even today, those who have been married for a long time, those who want to be married, those who were once married and are no longer married, that we need to recommit ourselves to these relationships and future relationships. And so if you're looking for a wife, if you're looking for a husband, if you already have a wife or a husband, I encourage you to come to this altar and pray for your mission during this next year. We have several minutes. Now, Jonathan, if you'll play softly for us, this altar is open to you. Would you please stand with me?